Okay, David.
Okay. So my assignment here, is, as you've heard, was to be provocative and not to take more than 15 minutes, or maybe not to take more than 10 minutes. So what I'm going to try to do is to give sort of the crudest imaginable outline of a militantly reductionist conception of the direction and of the very idea of time. I'll be talking here, just for the sake of simplicity, as if the fundamental ontology of the world and the fundamental dynamical laws of the world were Newtonian or maybe Maxwellian. But the idea, of course, is that there are going to be analogous things that one can say about the general relativistic quantum mechanical sort of world that we actually live in. Okay. Here are a couple, four important senses in which our experience of the world seems to exhibit a temporal directedness. There's the second law of thermodynamics. There's the preponderance of outgoing over incoming radiation. There is something that philosophers call the asymmetry of epistemic access, which refers to the fact that the kinds of things we find we can know about the past and the ways we have of knowing about the past are radically different from the kinds of things that we find we can know about the future and the ways we have of knowing about the future. And something called, this isn't supposed to be an exhaustive list, these are four important ones that we can talk about. And something philosophers call, well, they call it lots of things. One thing you can call it is the asymmetry of intervention. This refers to the fact that we make our way around in the world with a very, very deep conviction to the effect that by acting now, we can influence the future, but not the past. Good. It seems to me that, in fact, physics has made a great deal of progress over the past century and a half in understanding the first two kinds of directedness that I mentioned, the second law of thermodynamics and the preponderance of outgoing over incoming radiation. But the last two seem, on the face of it, much more mysterious, much less obviously related to fundamental physics. And indeed, there's been a long tradition of thinking, especially of this last one, this asymmetry of intervention in particular, as, well, in philosophy, as a matter of some sort of conceptual or linguistic or metaphysical or phenomenological kind of an analysis, and not as a proper subject of study for the natural sciences at all. There's a corresponding attitude in some parts of physics where these last two kinds of directedness are often thought to be the sorts of problems which the solving of which is going to require a profound conceptual revolution in physics. It's going to require concepts being dealt with in physics of the kind that haven't been dealt with there before, concepts that go under the name of becoming or passage or flow or something like that. And what I have in mind when I speak of a militantly reductionist conception of the directedness of time is a way of resisting these traditions, the philosophical one and the scientific one that I mentioned. Let me make this as vivid as I can. Imagine that we were to discover that on a certain planet, we're only able to know reliably and in detail about objects that are located to our right and not about objects that are located to our left. Or that we were to discover that on a certain planet, we were only able to influence objects that are located to our north and that we weren't able to influence objects that are located to our south. What would people do? Or more particularly, what would scientists do? Or what would scientists that we consider responsible do under such circumstances? Nobody's going to be looking for a conceptual or linguistic or metaphysical or phenomenological account of what's going on here. People are going to be looking for things like fields or filters or mirrors or smoke or something. They're going to be looking, that is, for something mechanical. And what I have in mind when I speak of a militantly reductionist conception of the directedness of time is the thought that we ought to be puzzled by these last two time asymmetries I mentioned, the ones that sound mysterious, in exactly the same way that we would have been puzzled by the hypothetical sorts of spatial asymmetries that I've just now described, and that what we ought to be trying to make sense of these temporal puzzles, just as we would have tried to make sense of those spatial asymmetries, that is, to make sense of them as mechanical phenomena of nature. And that, as a matter of fact, it seems to me, we can already see dimly but well enough, and in an absolutely clear and lowbrow and flat-footed sort of a way that doesn't involve any fancy or unfamiliar talk about becoming or flow or passage, and indeed, with nothing more in hand than the fundamental physics that we already have, I think we can see how that might work. Goes without saying that this is a large and ongoing project. I'm not going to have time to say anything very substantial about it here. Let me just try to give you a sense, as if from a great distance, of the overall architecture of a project like this. I'll start at the top and try to work my way down. Do I have like 5 minutes left or something? I have 10 minutes left? Wow, I have nothing to say. So look, the core of our fundamental physical account of the laws of thermodynamics, which was first sketched out by Boltzmann, and I think Boltzmann, you know, after 100 years of reflection, did a pretty good job of it, consists of a progressively deeper and more general and more mathematically sophisticated set of arguments to the effect that a proposition like the following is plausibly true. Here's the proposition. Consider a true thermodynamical law, any true thermodynamical law, to the effect that a certain macro condition A evolves under such and such external circumstances and over such and such a temporal interval into macro condition B. Whenever such a law holds, the overwhelming, here's the proposition that he made plausible. Whenever such a law holds, the overwhelming majority of the volume of the region of phase space associated with macro condition A, on a certain very simple measure of volume, is taken up by micro conditions which are sitting on deterministic Newtonian trajectories which pass under the allotted circumstances at the end of the allotted interval through the region of phase space associated with macro condition B. And so, if we stipulate that the probability that the macro condition of a system, that the micro condition of a system in macro condition A lies within some particular subregion of the region of phase space associated with A is proportional to the volume of that subregion, this stipulation is usually referred to as the statistical postulate, then we get the result that the thermodynamical law in question correctly describes the way in which such a system is overwhelmingly likely to behave. Good. That's, in essence, Boltzmann's project. I think it's the right way of trying to understand things like the second law of thermodynamics. There is, as everybody knows, a famous trouble with Boltzmann's argument, which is that it works exactly as well backwards as it does forwards, and of course, when you run this, you know, when you run this argument back forwards, you get exactly the results you want. When you run this argument backwards, you get preposterous results, like the smoke was more condensed 10 minutes ago, or the ice was less melted 10 minutes ago, or something like that. And there is a canonical procedure for making that trouble go away, something which more or less occurred to Boltzmann himself as well. And that canonical procedure is to supplement the fundamental dynamical equations of motion and the standard statistical postulate with a new fundamental physical law, which is usually referred to nowadays as the past hypothesis, to the effect that the initial condition of the universe was some very compact, very low entropy, and otherwise cosmologically sensible macro condition. And this is the place, and this is the only place, where anything time asymmetric enters into the Boltzmannian account of the laws of thermodynamics. And I think it can be made plausible, and I'm not going to make it plausible, I'm just going to be provocative here. I think it can be made plausible that at the end of the day, if you keep your eye on the ball, and if you think carefully enough about what things mean, this is all that's going to be required in order to account for the entirety of our experience of temporal directedness in all of its subtlety and in all of its variety. What we're talking about, and all we're talking about, when we talk about the fact that we can remember the past but not the future, or when we talk about the fact that we can influence the future but not the past, all we're talking about when we say things like that are patterns in which matter and fields happen to be distributed over the static, directionless block of space-time. The business of describing those patterns in a way that actually makes contact with the language of fundamental physics, mind you, can be very difficult. But it's not impossible if you're clever and you're clear and you're patient. And our experience so far is that when we do manage to describe them in that way, what we invariably find we have in front of us when we're done is a straightforward consequence of the laws of Boltzmannian statistical mechanics. Let me give you just one very, well, no, you know what, let me skip the example. Maybe we'll come back to it in discussion. There are a couple of very simple examples of the success of that kind of analysis, which I think are impressive and which maybe we can talk about at some point. Let me just, before I stop, mention one more matter. There's a very natural extension of the sorts of considerations I've just been talking about that runs as follows, and an extension which it's almost impossible not to make once you get into this mood. Why not think not only of the distinction between past and future, but of the very idea of time and of the very distinction between, say, time and space as nothing more or less than a concise and informative way of talking about the patterns in which matter and fields are distributed over some more fundamental manifold, a manifold which has no fundamental spatial or temporal structure at all. This thought, and as far as I know, this thought goes back to a beautiful paper of D.W. Williams from the 60s, I think, called The Myth of Passage. The thought goes something like this. Suppose that the distribution of matter and fields over this fundamental four-dimensional manifold is such that we can identify some foliation of that manifold, which has the property that there's some simple rule that relates the distribution of matter and fields over any one leaf of that foliation to the distribution of matter and fields over any other leaf of that foliation. Those rules, then, are called dynamical laws. And the individual leaves of the foliation are called times. And the geometry of space, but this is too long a story to get into here, turns out have to do with the mathematical structure of this dynamical law. And the thought is that there needs to be nothing more fundamental to any of them than that. Good. I was within time. I provided a good example for everybody else. I can stop there.
Time of discussion. Rich?
Time has reached a point where it's time to move away from the
Aristotle, whose approach to time, he wrote a book on the subject, was to try to make it plausible and believable and something where we could say, yeah, that feels right, and move instead into the Einstein era, where Einstein refused to write a theory unless he could show you how it was falsifiable. And I believe we are at that moment now, to use another time expression, when our emphasis should be not on feel-good theories, but rather on theories that provide tests. My favorite example is the arrow of time and entropy, which has failed every experimental test you can imagine and is simply explained away and really does not make any falsifiable predictions. I think it's time to move on to the Einstein standard.
I'm surprised to hear this view referred to as a feel-good theory. I mean, it seems a particularly acute kind of feel-bad theory. That is, it's a theory asserting that the sort of the most subtle and what we take to be the most human features of our experience of the world have a thoroughly flat-footed, metaphysically simple, mechanical description. It seems to me that Aristotle's view of it's been a while since Aristotle played a crucial role in modern physics, and the program that's being advocated here is one very much as you suggested that relies heavily on clearly falsifiable theories that we've already had a lot of experience with. The claim is we've had the fundamental physical resources to understand these things for a long time. We haven't yet been clever enough to see how those physical resources in detail do yield the kind of world that we actually experience.
Okay, and people should, again, say their names the first time you speak. That was Rich Mueller. Carlo.
Carlo Rovelli. I agree 100% with what David had said. In fact, I would subscribe to everything. I think it's perfect, this presentation. So this comment is not a criticism in any sense. I want to make two very short points which come clear from this discussion, which regard the entire discussion. So I'm addressing all of us, and I would like to insist that we should do two things. First thing, one of the questions that was presented as the theme of the discussion is whether time is fundamental or illusory. I think there can't be any, is a cat fundamental or is a cat illusory? I mean, is Lee Smalling fundamental or is Lee Smalling illusory? Certainly fundamental, but I chose a bad example. The large majority of the concepts that we use to talk about our experience, everything, are neither fundamental nor illusory. Right. So the question is badly ill-posed, okay? So let's keep this in mind. If we focus on the question, is it fundamental or illusory, we'll sidetrack it forever. That's the first point.
Fundamental or emergent?
Wait. The second, which is related to that, and also comes very clear from David's talk, is that when we're talking about time, we're talking about a lot of different things. And a lot of discussion is, I hear people discussing, and I hear one person meaning something with time, another person meaning something else with time. So in David's account, time was used in three different ways. As a directional flowing or whatever time that he was claiming can be accounted in terms of something else. As a Newtonian time, which was given for granted in the first half of his talk. and was questioned in the second half of this talk. So it seems to me that when we say time is this or time is that, we should start by saying what are we referring to. Because one thing is our experience of time, one thing is Newtonian time, one thing is Lorentzian time, in which there are many, one thing is proper time in general relativity, one thing is coordinate time in general relativity, one thing is a preferred foliation. Each one is a different discussion. And if we keep discussing if time is real or not real or illusory, we are mixing up everything horrendously. So I would ask everybody who talks about time, who talk about which of the many meanings that we give to this word he's referring to.
Okay, Avi, was that a finger?
Yes. May I approach
the board?
Can we remove the screen?
Can we move the screen? Not so easily, because we're about to use it, but you can use the board.
They gave me an office, so I have an excuse why I don't wear my tag. My tag is in the office, so I'm Avi Elitzur. To your question, Carlo, so here is something which I don't know, whether it is real or illusory. Which part of the blackboard should I? There I go. This is thanks to a beautiful thought experiment by Lucian Hardy many years ago. After Weidman and myself discovered interaction-free measurement, came Lucian with something which is much more shrewd. Imagine an electron being split by a beam splitter into two halves, and then imagine a positron being split by a beam splitter into two halves. Hardy managed to show that there is something very paradoxical going on as long as they did not annihilate. A year ago, Cohen and myself came with what seems to be a solution to the interaction-free measurement, and we proposed the following. Suppose that this half of the positron crosses those two paths of the electron, and we select for the cases in which there is no annihilation. Something very interesting is happening. All this vanishes, so the positron has collapsed, and the electron remains oblivious of the entire interaction. Why do I think that a law discovered in 1666 is somehow violated by this? Okay, action and reaction. This is affected by it such that if you make interference, the momentum of the positron is now disturbed. The electron remains oblivious of all this. Its momentum is intact. So I will not go into it, but to your question, Carlo, here is something. I told Hardy, and I think that he agrees with me, you can take your word back, that we have been neglecting all along two other particles here. When we were selecting the case of no annihilation, there was a photon that could have emerged here, and a photon that could have emerged here. And there are two detectors which could be very far from here. It is these detectors that did not click that gave rise to this strange thing, that there is an interaction, one of the parties is affected, and the other is not affected. What is the status of these gamma photons? Have they been emitted or never been emitted? Any suggestions? So I didn't know what to make of it, and this is how the quantum liar paradox came. So let me finish that one of the students here proposed the following name for these photons. I didn't know whether to call them antiphotons or virtual photons. He said, why don't you call them non-photons? And then Rich Miller suggests that with these non-photons, perhaps we can make nonsense of what time and all the rest. Thank you.
Okay, that's an intervention which is to be continued. I have Andy, then Yurik, then Barbara.
So I guess in the group that failed to be provoked by your comments. I think that's just how I like to think about it, but I would like to inject a feel bad comment, and especially it's related to Neil's comment about it leads to one of the things where I feel there's a real tension and real confusion, which is, you sort of proceeded along these logical constructions to the point where you said, so therefore we know the initial conditions need to be basically low entropy.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, in the cosmology world, most of us think it's our job to show that the initial conditions are typical, or in fact, most of us think we've done that. I don't think we have, but I'm just putting it out there as a tension that I feel is in the current thinking, and I think, yeah, right. So,
right.
Well, that's,
I mean, which I
is,
saw it,
which is where, which
I
Roger Penrose showed us
Penrose's
is where the
of
yeah,
it a long time
yeah,
ago
yeah.
that the vanishing of the Weyl tensor in
it's
the
exactly
initial condition
that, yeah.
is supposed to make it very low entropy and wildly atypical,
right.
Where more typical states you have the space-time is much more crunchy, as it were. And no, as far as I know, of course you guys know a million times more about this than I do, but my understanding is that current cosmological speculations are very much in line with a low entropy initial state.
And if anything, so people often try to say that inflation makes them typical, but in fact, if you take the standard Big Bang and then add some inflation,
I mean there are all kinds of other, you know, here is another place for Carlo's the kind of caution that Carlo was talking about what kind of time we're talking about. There's a question of what kind of typicality, issues of flatness, issues of uniform temperature, issues of fine-tuning, so on and so forth. These are sort of at right angles to this question of the lowness of the initial entropy.
Or are they? So I think that's a nice source of tension. And I mean, I'll definitely talk more about that on Wednesday, and we'll probably talk some more.
I'm trying to do a job of separating fingers from hands.
Oh, don't do that.
Yeah, that sounds painful.
Fingers should be quick.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm a little bit confused about what Andy was saying, because I felt that in the beginning he says that you were saying that the initial conditions should be typical, and then you agreed that they should not be typical.
Okay. That's what I was trying to do, was confuse you.
Okay, great. So I completely...
I think the confusion is represented in... You
know, no, I think the confusion is just because of some, I don't know, some strange philosophical views about inflation. I don't see any confusion. I do think that initial state should be special just for the various reasons that people have said. And it is our job, as you pointed out, that to find the appropriate laws or appropriate conditions, some appropriate generalization of Weyl curvature hypothesis to the quantum world. It is
right.
Very classical hypothesis.
Right.
So that is our job. And once that is done, then it would seem to me that the initial condition will be special. One quick thing. If the initial conditions could not be typical, because if the initial conditions were typical, then you evolve, then what you obtain is going to be typical. So if I evolve back in time, I would never obtain the universe that I see, which is very, very simple in the beginning. So it doesn't seem any reason to believe that the initial conditions are typical.
Can we bracket this issue of this tension that Andy introduces as something that we'll come back to over and over again? Now I have a few more fingers on this issue, then we'll go on to hands. Neil, you had, was that a finger some time ago?
Let me get a microphone.
I'll be very short. I wanted to disagree with David. I mean, I think it was a beautiful introduction and very, very clear. But the way I want to disagree is that, you know, throughout your discussion, you have a notion of a statistical ensemble and phase space, right?
Yeah. Of course, that's a limitation of the classical discussion, but maybe I don't know where you're going.
Okay, so where I'm going is that in GR, this issue is not
sure.
at all trivial.
Yes, of course.
The Hamiltonian is zero.
Right.
If you told Boltzmann, you're free to discuss statistical mechanics, but the energy is always zero.
Right.
He wouldn't be able to get started.
Absolutely right.
Okay. So we have very, very fundamental puzzles as soon as we introduce gravitation into the laws of physics.
Sure.
And so I think it's not as straightforward as you're saying.
That's absolutely right. Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Great. Yes. Second point I want to make is that. All right.
Okay, so it's a compliment and a point. I really enjoyed your talk. You made very good points about why we should be thinking about time, this asymmetry, and we are not usually. That's
what?
The compliment. For Carlo, I wanted to say that we are not confused when we say that there is multiple times, the Newtonian time, the statistical time, the thermodynamic time. We are saying there is one time, and the time is fundamental. Time is always moving forward in all regimes. So the microscopic time and of our usual description is that time can be moved forward or backward, or there's no directionality of time. And that is what we're saying we're going against. So in this description, that the proposal that we're trying to make is that time has a direction in all the regimes of physics. And in this sense, there are no different times. There is no Newtonian time. The Newtonian time is only symmetric time, symmetric because we go to initial conditions to argue for that. Well, the people that are defending that time is a fundamental concept and not an emergent, and it's not emergent in a quantum gravity description. That's the only thing I wanted to say.
Well, actually, if I could have, I would have done two fingers, but but for the British people here, I thought that wasn't very polite. So the first figure was very, just a word, it was very similar to what Neil said. I think that Boltzmann's framework is a little bit out of date, and another way of seeing that is that the available phase space in cosmology, this is a session on cosmology,
right,
is infinite. So all those arguments that we're thinking of everything in a box and finite phase space, I think.
Oh, okay. I don't think,
but
I'll have
that, anyway,
to say
that
about
was
that.
The other one is the one I wanted to really say, which is that why are we asking ourselves about time at all? And of course, it's a fascinating question, but for a practicing physicist, it seems to me that the real importance is that it's giving us a clue to this further theory that we don't yet have, this further way of thinking. And from that point of view, something which in our personal experience seems to conflict strongly with the picture that you were laying out can actually be very fruitful. For example, your arguments against passage or becoming or what were the analogy between time and space. What if in our fundamental theory there is no notion of space as such, but there are only temporal relations, as is the case in a causal set that
right.
Marina referred to?
Right.
On the one hand, the analogy would break down. On the other hand, we may feel, this is a promising direction if we want to incorporate a kind of becoming at the more fundamental level.
Right. I mean, a couple of things. If there are real tensions between our experience of being in the world and our physics, no doubt that's a fruitful place to begin to look for more physics. But it seems, the answer to the question whether the tension is real or not seems like an important one. Under those circumstances. And the claim I was making, I didn't see it as based on this analogy between time and space. And indeed, when I was talking at the end about possibilities of viewing time as emergent, that goes along with viewing space as emergent as well. I just hinted at that.
I didn't understand what
But anyway, forget about that. The basic idea is that there is this program in place. And of course, this program has lots of promissory notes, and what Neil was saying was very relevant to that, and so on and so forth. But there is a program whose overall architecture you can sort of see. It has a lot of promises still to deliver. But there's a sort of argument that, no, in fact, if you think about it carefully enough, if you think about what our ordinary language means carefully enough, so on and so forth, the thing that looked like a tension with our fundamental physics evaporates. So it does seem important to know whether or not that's true before one is confident that thinking about this tension is going to be a way to discover new physics.
Okay, I'm going to go, I do see, okay, and finger there, but we're going to go to your, because we have 10 minutes and then we'll go to our next, for about the two. So I, just to say, I have those hands, Yurik, Barbara, and Lisa. And if we get there, Zhao, but Zhao, maybe.
All right, I will try to be short. Well, what worries me and what I would like to revisit again is this question that actually appeared already, what time we're talking about. And my question is, are we talking the ontological time of philosophers, which is that we're talking about ontology of some notion? And then...
I'm not sure I know what that is.
Let me finish. And then this notion can be equipped with the... And then this notion might be equipped with the arrow or any property you like. And then the question is how the physical system inherits some properties of the, from this time. On the other hand, we may talk about the physical time, so time of physical theories. But then the problem is that if you're talking physics, all the notions might be or must be operatively defined one way or another, or at least in principle operatively defined. And then I don't quite see, so we must be extremely careful about defining physical notion of part-time, because then we need really to express explicitly how we want to measure it. What's the measurement process and how we interpret this measurement process? Or we're talking something in between. And then, of course, there are no rules. We can do whatever we want. So this is my worry, and from your introduction, I it wasn't clear to me which time you're really talking about, which of these three fundamental
I'm not sure I know what you mean by the ontological notion. I think what Carlos said is very helpful to keep in mind here.
Let's stop you there.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Barbara Drossel, a statistical physicist. Thank you for the clear talk. Nevertheless, I want to disagree on two basic points. One is this notion that there is maybe just one fundamental theory which is focused on the smallest particles, the elementary particles, and which is deterministic and time reversal invariant. I think that's a very narrow view of nature, and we know that any theory is an idealization which neglects many features of nature, which has limits of validity and a limited range of applicability. And in particular, I don't agree that statistical mechanics can be reduced to classical or quantum mechanics. And when you outlined the derivation that Boltzmann gave, in fact, you used the concept or the notion overwhelmingly probable. Mm-hmm. So you introduced the concept of probabilities, which simply doesn't make sense in a deterministic view. There is no room for probabilities and for options.
So, good. I think that's a very useful very useful comment. There are a couple of things there, each of which is worth attending to. I do see physics as in the business of aspiring to a complete, simple, fundamental account of the world. of course, it's the case that physics has not achieved anything like that. And, you know, I'm not going to hold my breath until it does. But sure, I do see, and maybe this is a fundamental disagreement, I do see physics as aspiring to something like that. I don't see any compelling reason to conclude from the history of physics that that's impossible, that's out of the question. So, the kind of question one is asking is, if we had the true and complete fundamental theory of the world, what would this account of time look like, and what guesses can we make about the shape of that account from what we know of our physical theories so far? So maybe there is a real disagreement there. Maybe you don't even see it as part of the proper aspiration of physics to aim at a theory like that. Maybe you think the idea of such a theory is incoherent or nonsensical or something like that. That is a disagreement between us. As to the other things you said, for example, quantum statistical mechanics not being deducible from, classical mechanics by itself or quantum mechanics by itself, I agree with that 100%. I think there are two fundamental postulates that have been added to classical mechanics in order to get what we call modern statistical mechanics or Boltzmannian statistical mechanics. One of them is a statistical postulate, exactly as you say. The other is this past hypothesis. It's absolutely right that they're not deducible from that. I think a lot of confusion in this field was caused by the fact that Boltzmann sort of wanted to see himself as deducing it from that and relied on very bad philosophical principles like a principle of indifference and so on to get the probabilities out of nowhere. I think that's a bad way to go about it. One should be upfront. The probabilities are a new empirical postulate over and above the microscopic equations of motion. You seem to say that because the microscopic equations of motion are deterministic, one has no room for an additional statistical postulate. That, I guess, I disagree with as well. One can perfectly consistently add to the deterministic equations of motion a probability distribution over initial conditions of the universe. There are deep philosophical questions about what it means to talk about the probability that the initial state of the universe, of which, after all, there's only one, was this or that. The universe presumably had exactly one microscopic initial condition, and one might wonder what it means to speak of the probability that it had this initial microcondition as opposed to that initial microcondition. That's a long story in foundational discussions of probability. I think there is a perfectly coherent way to tell this story. This goes back to the work of David Hume and was developed a lot in the 20th century by people like David Lewis and my friend Barry Lower and so on. So I think there's a good question there. I also think there's a good answer to that question.
We will come back to that discussion, I'm sure. It's a core issue. Lisa, for the last comment.
Okay. So first, I'm Lisa Glaser. I do quantum gravity, preferably on the computer. So I think we can, the one sentence summary of what you were arguing for was that time is going from low entropy state to a high entropy state, that this is somehow the emergence of time. Very simplified, but.
That would be a good place to start. Yeah.
Thinking in headlines.
Yeah.
Now, when I try to think about time, I'm influenced by my work in which I put a whole universe on the computer. So I'm thinking of a block universe.
Right.
And then I think the natural question that when you combine these two is, why does actually the point of low entropy align itself with the direction of time in my universe on the computer?
Right.
Where Carlo makes a very good point. We should be clear about what notion of time we use. I would think of time as the parameter that goes along a world line, as
right.
this parameter
right.
in a GR time. So why these two notions that originally are very independent of each other would align.
I think that's a really good question. I mean, of course, you don't mean literally. Of course, I could parameterize it by negative numbers as opposed to positive numbers, but I understand exactly what you mean. And that's a really good question, and that is typical of the kind of question that any Boltzmannian approach to the second law of thermodynamics is obliged to give a clear answer to. There's a whole collection of questions like this. Why are the increases in entropies of separate isolated systems going in parallel? Why is the increase of entropy going in parallel with the natural cosmological time parameter? All kinds of stuff like this. These are questions which I believe a Boltzmannian approach has good and clear answers to, but you're absolutely right to demand such answers. And there's a lot to say about that.
Okay, great. This is really great. Thank you.
Oh.
No, you're done for
now. Okay.
And now we have Steven Weinstein. The shape of the day, by the way, just while Steve is getting ready, is that the whole day. Can you give me a microphone? Starting today with the questions of the arrow of time to get started, to put all the discussions of the week into context. We're starting with two philosophers of physics, David and Steve, who have, and it would be an understatement to say there's a tension between the views that they're presenting. That's what we're doing in the morning. In the afternoon, we come back at 2:00. We have three cosmologists, Marina Cortez, Sean Carroll, and Tim Kozlowski. Similarly, they'll give provocations. We'll have discussion about them. Then we take a coffee break. Then we'll bring all five of them up to the front. We'll have a discussion with all five of them. And here is Steve.
Here I am. Thanks for having me. I want to, what? That costs money. I want to offer a perspective on the direction of time that's a little different from the one that David sketched, which is indeed a common approach with focusing on the thermodynamic arrow and a low entropy initial condition. I've always found this to be a little bit problematic. It kind of reeks of fine tuning. And it presupposes, this will be a little more controversial, I think, a theory of a general theory of gravitational thermodynamics that we don't have. In other words, we're talking about low entropy in an infinite gravitating universe. And I'm not sure what that means. So regardless of what you feel about that, this is a different approach. I'm going to focus on electromagnetism and the electromagnetic arrow. And this came out of thinking about Maxwell theory, a kind of an epistemological problem about how do we make predictions in Maxwell theory. And my claim, this is supposed to be provocative, I hope so, is that Maxwell's time-symmetric electrodynamics provides us with no predictions in the absence of an additional assumption. And this assumption renders the theory time-asymmetric. And the assumption is not going to be special low entropy initial condition, at least in any obvious way. So I just want to take you through that. It's a kind of a paradox. I'll illustrate it, and then we'll have some interesting discussion. So the equations, everybody knows these. We have two constraint equations at each point involving spatial derivatives, and this is going to be important, of the E and the B fields. Two evolution equations at each point, also involving spatial derivatives that give the time derivatives of the E and the B fields. And then, of course, we have the Lorentz force law, which gives the back reaction of the field on the charges. How do the charges behave in response to the changes in the field? And on the face of it, the way we ordinarily think, most of us think anyway, about electrodynamics, we can make predictions and test the theory by specifying the electric and magnetic fields and the charge distribution along a space-like hypersurface. So we have a more or less a well-posed initial value problem. I say more or less because I don't want to problematize it, but I do understand that there are difficulties which were fought over quite a lot in the mid-20th century about coupling the infinities that arise when you're coupling matter to the fields. But that's not going to be my topic. So where's the paradox come from? It's the paradox comes from that green doesn't show up on this projector at all. Well, okay. Lesson learned. So what's supposed to be here, I have no idea what the next slide is going to look like, is a light cone. We have an observer who's, we're assuming, is at T0 and has to make a prediction about what he or she is going to see at T1 up here. And there's supposed to be a past light cone of this observer here. And what this says, see, this is green and it does show up, is that the data available, this is the data, the past light cone contains the data available to the observer at T0, as a best case anyway. Okay, it's not generally the case that you can see everything in your past light cone. There's plenty of shielding, but grant access to all that data in this region, this past region. How in the world do you make any prediction here? What you need to predict this is clearly a little section of this space-like hypersurface of some initial data surface. And you need data along here. But this data is space-like to the observer. So the observer can't, on the face of it, say anything about what happens here. Now, obviously, we use the theory all the time. Make predictions, we regard it as extremely well confirmed. So what do we do? How are we actually using the theory? And let's see what this surprise this holds for me. Well, not too bad. Okay, what we do is we have access to information coming from the past, from charges in the past. So this charge, for instance, this is just a simple universe with one accelerating, slightly accelerating charge and one observer. This charge appears, as any massive object will, in the past light cone of the observer. The observer knows that the charge is there because it's been, to the extent that it's been emitting anything, okay? So something like the sun, all right, makes itself manifest. And then, by knowledge of the sources, in the past light cone, you can predict what's going to show up here, okay? So we do this with the stars, with the sun, with everything. We have a charge source, an emitter. We know how it behaves. We figure out, we extrapolate what it's going to be doing at this point, just a past of T1. And that's how we make a prediction. So this is just some examples of sources. I included, of course, the BlackBerry, which is probably the best source you can get, as everybody at Perimeter knows. Also a router, a sun. So this is almost mundane. This is what we do. But this doesn't come out of the initial value problem that we looked at. What is it? One of the things that we're doing is we're assuming, the important thing that we're assuming is that we don't have any free radiation. There are no source-free solutions in here. There's nothing coming in that's going to upset the apple cart. This person's trying to predict this. We don't have anything coming in along this light cone, okay, from past infinity. So my claim is that in the electrodynamics that we actually use and that we've confirmed, we assume that all radiation is retarded radiation from massive charged objects, massive so that they're in our past light cone. And the behavior of these objects, the future behavior, can be predicted from their prior behavior. We know something about them, so and that's how, to the extent that we know about what they're going to do, we can predict what we're going to see. Okay, if they're new objects, then we don't necessarily know what to expect, and that's what observation, in particular astronomical observation, involves. So this implies, but I'll just say it again here, is that there's no source-free radiation coming in from the past. Okay. If there is, all bets are off as to what you're going to observe at T1. And the upshot is all radiation is generated by sources in the past, and this is a time asymmetric assumption, and it's essential to the predictive value of electrodynamics. And what I'm suggesting is that we regard that assumption as part of the theory. It's a kind of boundary condition. That only you only have a predictive theory if you couple these differential equations to a particular time asymmetric boundary condition. An interesting corollary of this is that the field at any given time is entirely a function of the past history of the charge distribution. Okay? So the field degrees of freedom are in principle superfluous.
What does that mean?
What is which?
That last sentence.
Superfluous?
I mean, the first sentence is something we're used to thinking
yeah.
all the time. And the second is one we're not used to thinking at all. So
okay.
we study E&M, mm-hmm. we're happy with the first, now you're telling us something different. So I'm just curious.
So you use the time to be with this formulation. There is another formulation of thermodynamics that feels no longer in time.
What you have to do is you have to integrate over the past history of the charges to get the fields at any given time.
But you just mean the field degrees of freedom are surplus for the initial condition. You need them to actually solve the equations along the way.
Not necessarily. It depends how you formulate the equations. So just let me get to the last point, and I'll come back to that. So the last point is, and maybe this provides a point of contact to the 1963 meeting and maybe to something that people are already familiar with. This is this is the time-symmetric Wheeler-Feynman absorber theory without the absorber, okay? So the Wheeler-Feynman theory, as many of you, how many people are familiar with the Wheeler-Feynman theory? Yeah. Half, okay. Was an attempt to do electrodynamics without the problematic fields. I believe it was intended to, as were many modifications of electrodynamics, to deal with the infinite self-energy of point particles. Okay, so in their theory, they had the fundamental degrees of freedom were the matter degrees of freedom. There was an additional future boundary condition, which said that all radiation is eventually absorbed in the future. Okay, so it has sources in the past and is absorbed in the future. This theory, I think, was successfully quantized, but it was dropped in part because it was seen to be cosmologically implausible in an expanding universe, that there was no evidence, there was no reason to think that radiation that went out to future null infinity was, well, there's no reason to think that it would escape to future null infinity. We don't think that there's an absorber out there to pick it all up. So what it is it's a variant of that. And so the fields, of course, here's the problem with it. Most of these theories, this one, the sort of cosmological models of the past hypothesis, rely on having something like an initial boundary, an initial condition, an initial singularity. So there's only a finite time in the past you can go over. And so for this, there's only a finite time in the past that you would have to integrate the particle trajectories to get the fields at the current moment. Now, if you have a universe that's infinite into the past in some sense, like in some versions of internal inflation or some interpretations of internal inflation, then the idea of a boundary condition, an initial boundary condition, goes away. And you also don't really have, in our universe, as far as we know, anything. There's nothing like asymptotic flatness. So we don't have conditions out spatial infinity. So all of these things have a hard time getting a foothold there. But I suggest thinking about this in terms of an initial boundary condition. And the fields up here are the product of the trajectories of all of the charges in the past light cone of any given point. So these charges all can be thought of as emitting radiation. But basically, if you know the charge distribution, you know everything. I think I'm going to stop there. That's what I wanted to say. That's trivial. Oh, because because of the sort of flippant way that I said it. What I said here is I said the electrodynamics we use is essentially the time-symmetric absorber theory without the absorber, which makes the... Yes. Okay, right. Yeah. Okay.
While people are raising their hands for the discussion, let me just ask Steve one point of clarification. You have two assertions on your transparency. The first makes reference to fields. All radiation is generated by sources in the past. This is a time asymmetric assumption is essential to the predictive value of electrodynamics. That is independent of the second assertion, which is that the fields are superfluous. So as we discuss these things, let's separate them. I think it's sufficiently provocative to think about the first before we get into the details of Wheeler-Feynman theory and the issue of the second. Okay, so
fair enough.
Yep. George? Are you guys
Yeah, George.
George Ellis, Cape Town. The point you make about not knowing the data, that there's one case in which you do know the data, and that is if we live in a small universe. That is a universe with compact spatial sections, which are so small that we've seen right around the universe since the time of last scattering. And you can test for this by looking for circles in the microwave background sky, which are identical in different directions in the sky. It looks like that's not the case, but it is certainly theoretically possible that we have already seen all of the matter in the universe.
Right, good.
Neil?
I just wanted to disagree with you about the initial value problem. It was some slides earlier. Mm-hmm. You claimed this has no predictive power at all without an assumption about some kind of boundary condition in the past. Yeah, so that's totally wrong. I mean, the statement is that within electrodynamics, I can parametrize any possible physical phenomenon through a given set of initial data on a spatial surface to the past, to my past, mm-hmm. which fills out my past light cone. That's a very, very powerful statement. It's just saying whatever you're trying to predict, you can explain it with something which fills out your past light cone. It's completely independent of initial conditions, stuff at infinity. So electrodynamics is an extremely predictive theory. It gives you a way to parametrize all possible electromagnetic phenomena. So,
I wasn't understood. I agree that there's a... Let me see if I can rephrase my point. My first statement.
No prediction. Yeah, that's totally wrong.
Right. Well, it's ambiguous. It was intentionally ambiguous because I was told to be provocative.
But don't make wrong statements.
Why not? Well, you make wrong statements. Yes.
Your special assumption is your initial value. I think that's
no.
That's the way.
Yeah,
absolutely.
No, well, my point was sort of an epistemological point, was that the initial data that we require is space-like. And if we conceive of ourselves, which we do, as located at a particular point on a spatial surface, we don't have access at that moment to the relevant data. What do you mean by
at any time, you take a slice, and you do your thing.
He is agreeing with that. And his main point is that there is no way to determine for this observer what this initial data was. That is the point.
Right.
You realize the possible
outcome. I'm not sure. What do you mean by parameterize it? Oh, sure, yeah, but... Right, and...
Okay,
we can come back to this. I don't agree with you, but...
Okay, you're the next thing.
Small comment, just to clarify that. Neil is obviously right. It doesn't seem to be in contradiction with what I heard he's saying, namely, certainly, if I know the data on a space-like surface like a particular future, more than that, if I know the data on a compact region of a space-like surface, I can predict the future in the future domain of dependence of this surface. Now, what he's saying is that in order for an observer located in space-time to know the data on a compact space-like surface, he cannot be located inside this compact surface because of special relativity, because formation doesn't go faster than light. So this space-time should be, the observer should be located in a position such that in his past last cone is, so in other words, should be located after the event that you want to predict. That's the point he's making. It's a which let me finish. It's nothing in contradiction.
Predictions is what I'm not agreeing with here.
Yeah.
You can make many predictions.
That's of
you
course.
Can't predict everything.
That's right. So I think what he's saying is that concretely in an experiment we say given this happened, provided that there isn't something at the speed of light that comes from infinity and between this and that burns everything. If there's a Newton star that arrives nearly speed of light, any prediction is going to be destroyed, and I don't know about the neutron star because it's going too fast. So I think this brings the two things together. What I disagree, the factual things you said are obviously right. What I disagree is that this is in contradiction with what David was saying, because in a saying you're just confirming. You're giving another example of the past hypothesis. We can effectively make predictions because the sky is dark and there isn't stuff arriving so much. So it seems fitting a lot with in David's scheme.
Yeah, I don't deny that it has there's some connection. I don't think that it's. I think the past hypothesis is much more general, and it's general and it's in that it covers all sorts of matter. But it's also more specific in that it tends to. Well, it depends what the version is. If the version is entropy is minimal at the initial singularity, there's nothing here that says you have.
Well,
to
he was. David was very vague in the past hypothesis. I mean, you can
well,
I mean, the electromagnetic field on scry minus in a very peculiar state, which is no incoming radiation for scry minus, which is one microstate, which is zero entropy because it's one microstate. So it can be worked out. I think I'm not sure this is the right way of working it out, but it's not.
There's a point of tension here. If I can use my prerogative as chair to make a point of summing up, there is a disagreement here, I think, and it's one that we'll come back to during the week, as to whether this hypothesis of no incoming radiation and the past hypothesis, as David stated it, are fundamental aspects of nature which stand in contradiction to the claim that the laws of nature are time symmetric, or whether they're somehow contingent features of our universe to be explained in a different way. And let's just keep track of this. It is a disagreement. David, you had a finger. Did you?
Actually, it very much overlaps with what Carlos said, but maybe just one sentence. Yeah, I think That is, there is, let's put it this way, it's not, what this observation does not stand at all in the way of is confirming the truth of the theory in as much detail as you like, okay? That is, you get to the point here, you see the situation there, you can also see the situation on the past light cone, and you can ask whether the local situation there is given in the way that electrodynamics says it should be by a positionized past light cone. At that point in time, you have both of those pieces of information, or at least both of those pieces of information are in principle available to you. So the theory can be confirmed. Also, any things you see can always be explained by past stuff that by the time you see it will already be available to you. Okay. It's true that there's a certain kind of prediction you can't do without these additional assumptions. So this is just a matter of making peace between
yeah, I think that makes sense.
Also,
yeah.
Carlos said, I was very short here. Of course, low entropy by itself is not remotely enough to characterize a reasonable past hypothesis. And claims about the kinds of boundary conditions that would get rid of advanced solutions seem like very, very natural components of what you would call a path.
Okay. Still in fingers.
My name is Yisheng Yang. I'm a postdoc here, but also a part-time experimentalist in CETA. So I'm going to echo Neil's point more from an observer point of view. You can go to the last slide here, please.
Okay,
can we go to your last slide?
Last slide, okay.
I'm going to disagree with your first point on the last slide.
Okay.
I say that, this one? Yeah, so you, okay, maybe not this one, but what, there's a place that you say you need to assume that there is no incoming free radiation, otherwise all prediction is out.
Here, is that what?
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't think I agree with that, because in practice, that is what we do. We observe something, we always have unknown noises, and we don't care, right? The point is that if we observe something only one time, you can suspect that maybe some incoming radiation from the past is going to conspire and just give you a false result. But what you really do in life is repeat measurement. For example, you look at a pulsar, you know it's going to give you a pulse every second. And even if there are some noises from unknown things coming just right in the light cone, they're not going to conspire and destroy every single pulse. They're not even going to conspire and destroy a peak in your Fourier transform. Right? So you still have a very predictive theory, even if you assume some random thing is coming in a light cone. You can still,
if you assume some what?
You just assume there's a random thing that's coming through a light cone.
Right.
It doesn't destroy any predictiveness of your theory if you just repeat your measurement and...
Right. I mean, let me just sort of say this. This little provocation was by way, in part, of getting us to think about the possibility of a time asymmetric electrodynamics in just this sense, and trying to work out the consequences of it, okay? I don't want to push too hard on the fact. I mean, one big problem for this, or a big question mark in my mind, I said there's no source for incoming radiation. Well, we have the cosmic microwave background. Now, I don't know what the source of that radiation is. If it's, you know, initially charged by the interaction of the plasma and then it's radiated, or if it's just an initial sea of electromagnetic fields in plasma interacting. That's an open question. But we work with that. That's an example, I think, of the kind of noise you're talking about, isn't it? Something that it's there, you discount it.
Okay, I have Andy, then Lucian, and then Braxton.
I'm a theorist. So I just want to make a challenge about the notion of infinity. So there's no experimental evidence that infinity has anything to do with physics, and there never will be. And so we've already had, it seems like a very useful abstraction that we use in a lot of cases, like E&M, to to have a more convenient way of talking about what we know, but we don't know if it's really there. And we've already had a few comments, oh, you can't, you've got an infinite universe, you can't blah, 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 blah. I forget what people have been saying, but watch it, because we don't know about infinity, and it may be wrong.
How about zero?
Same thing, yeah. I mean, there's, you know, a physicist's zero is epsilon. A mathematician's zero is something else.
So, Andy, is this directed, is George?
Not directed so much.
But George mentioned the compact universe. Is that the kind of thing you have
well,
in mind?
Well, I mean, literally, the Hilbert space may be finite if you're talking about quantum mechanics. And we'll never know otherwise. For any theory that has a continuum and that has an infinity, there'll be a version of it on a lattice, et cetera, mm-hmm. that reproduces everything, every data point you have. And it may be more ugly, and that's where the infinity will add value, but by giving, or maybe not, or maybe more elegant. But I think when we get into, you know, I'm forgetting the details, but there's been a few comments along the way this morning that because the universe is infinite, you've got to think a certain way or not. And I just say, look out, you know, be careful about that.
Let me, again, part of my role is to mark significant issues when they're first raised. It's not just an issue about infinity. There's an issue about the role of mathematics in physics and cosmology. And that will, I promise, without knowing how it will be introduced, it will be introduced and may come to dominate some aspects of the discussion of the nature of time. So, Lucien?
So I'm Lucien Hardy from Perimeter. So this picture you have of a sort of observer moving along a world line, it isn't really how experiments are done. You think about an experiment, then you know, the experimentalist sets up a laboratory or spends some time basically sort of mapping out some region of space where they're very careful about the initial conditions so that the experimentalist, although the experimentalist, he may disappear, he may get on the pub, but the experiment itself is something that's set up over a region of space, and you know he'll pull down the blinds to try and control for such radiation. You know, you'll make your laboratory dark and so on. So I think this picture isn't quite the right picture. A different picture is you know an operational picture is where you set up your experiment over a region of space, and so you don't have this problem.
Well, I understand your point. I think this picture was motivated by thinking more cosmologically and thinking in terms of making observations in the universe, which are not experiments. There's no preparation. If you're here, you're trying to figure out what is the sky going to look like tomorrow night. So it's that was the context. I think this can carry over to what you're saying, but I understand completely, and I think this makes contact with Neil with what you were saying.
Indeed, yeah.
Okay, that use. Which finger?
I just want to say this discussion also applies to gravitational radiation, and exactly what you're saying is incredibly relevant to those gravitational radiation observations.
Thank you. I was reluctant to bring that up.
So I just had a thing. I'm Sean Gribb. I just had a finger about your comment. I just wanted to kind of half defend the view about the discomfort that people have about talking about infinite dimensional phase spaces. And for me, the issue is defining measures and the ambiguity that you have when you try to do that. And that has a discrete analog as well. I mean, if you don't know the details of that lattice that exists, then you still don't really know how to sensibly talk about measures. And to me, that's the problem, is that, you know, when you see statements about this is typical or the initial conditions for inflation are typical, you get different answers depending on who did the calculation. And the answer tends to support the person's particular view. So, So my view on this is more if we want to do some real physics, you know, maybe we should be thinking about the other issues that David brought up, which is not we've been talking a lot about the past hypothesis in the first issue, but there's also this, in my opinion, more interesting points about asymmetric epistemic access and intervention. to me, those seem like areas that could, where like progress could be made, because we haven't really talked about it that much, whereas the and other ones we have talked a lot about. So anyway, I think we're going to talk about it later today. Yes. Yeah. And today's afternoon, right?
Yeah, let me make one quick point on that. Well, quickly, I thought about this a bit. Sean, to your point about thinking about the directed nature, I think this is what you're getting at, of the observer, about how you characterize the observer. When I said that you, in principle, the observer at T0, where's my laser, has access to the past light cone, this really relies on the fact that the observer has a memory of what he's experienced in the past, a memory, you know, which requires a thermodynamic arrow, arguably. Otherwise, all you have is, you know, it's kind of the solipsism of the present moment. You have what you can see now and try to make a prediction on that basis. And that's pretty thin data.
Hello, everybody. I'm Vasu from Perimeter. And I feel like my what I was going to say has been subsumed by what Sean he said. But the point is that if we were going to use this to try to explain the arrow of time, then it seems to be very reliant on how you model the observer. And then the question becomes, are you modeling an observer in a universe? Or are you modeling an observer in some sufficiently isolated region, so a quasi-local, for all practical purposes, infinity? Which is what we usually do when we talk about the radiation zone and an observer sitting at infinity to try to measure it. But in some sense, it's an observer in an isolated region or in a quasi-local part of the universe. So then are we explaining the arrow of time for observers in such regions, or are we trying to or is this trying to extend to explain the arrow of time in any region of that kind, so in the whole universe? So there's some distinction here to be made or not. So what are your thoughts about that?
I think everything reduces to the universe. This is a cosmological discussion.
Great.
If I can answer this to you.
I'd like that because it's simple. I'm not sure I understood the whole point. I think it has something to do, though, with, you know, it only at infinity or in the pure radiation zone, right? And what do you say about the fields, like the Coulomb field of a charge near the observer? And I think I haven't really discussed that adequately.
I just mean that you are making this idealization, but it is an idealization, as
right.
She said, that if you're going to go look at pulsars and things, then you do have noise that's coming in because you're not really in this properly isolated region. So in some sense, if you're going to try to use this to explain the arrow of time, it feels as though it depends on how well isolated this region is, so that you can say that, yes, this is pure radiation.
I see. Yeah, I think my main takeaway from this was, like, when we do see some new signal in the sky, we look for a source.
Sure.
And that's telling us something about how we use it to the, well, it's the implicit use of the Sommerfeld boundary condition.
Okay, that says what I was going to say. David?
This is just a brief comment on the a few commentators ago, somebody said, and it was just sort of repeated again now, that, look, we don't really need these initial conditions of zero radiation that doesn't have its source in particles. We get noise all the time. We know how to discount it, and the idea was that in order for that noise to be misleading, it would require a fantastic conspiracy, so on and so forth. But look, the great lesson of the sort of reversibility objections to Boltzmann is that without something like a past hypothesis, exactly these sorts of conspiracies are what is overwhelmingly likely, overwhelmingly likely. So it's not true that you have any kind of a sort of justification in the absence of something like a past hypothesis for dismissing these conspiracies. In the absence of a past hypothesis, these conspiracies are exactly what statistical mechanics is going to say is overwhelmingly likely to have happened.
So calling them conspiracies is temporal provincialism.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So, hello, I'm Niyayesh Afshirdi. I'm a cosmologist at PI and at University of Waterloo. So I wanted to make shed a different light on this perspective. So I'm wondering whether what you describe as a hypothesis is really a choice of a problem you would like to focus on, and maybe generalize that to the whole notion of arrow of time, that maybe it's not really something about nature, but rather something, a sociological agreement amongst physicists about what problem you would like to focus on. For example, particle physicists build colliders and talk about the scattering processes, and they all do make this assumption that you're saying, that they assume you start from vacuum, you turn on interactions, and particles come in and interact, and something goes out. And that's the choice. So the group of physicists got together and decided that this is the problem we'd like to focus on. So it's not really a hypothesis about the physics, but a sociological or community agreement that, okay, this is a problem we find interesting and we're going to work on it. Cosmologists, on the other hand, are not making that assumption. They assume that there might have been a stuff coming out of the Big Bang, and that they decide to focus on that. And that's a different hypothesis. So I guess I want to throw that this out there, that maybe what we think as the arrow of time, which is, one way of thinking about it is what you suggested, is not really something about nature, but the sociological argument amongst physicists, who we decide to focus on this problem that with certain type of initial condition, there could be other communities that think a different way. There could be other communities that decide that we want to fix something in the future, and decide that we want to consider all possibilities that lead to that particular future. I guess politicians maybe do that.
the fact that I can't unstir the cream from my coffee isn't a sociological.
Well, I think there you have something, a goal in mind, which is, I guess, I think that's a longer discussion, but I think I can try to argue that it might be.
Okay, let's close the discussion again, just to emphasize issues. So Niyayesh, you're raising a new issue, which I've, to my understanding, directly challenges what David just said, which is that a past hypothesis is necessary to reproduce the world as we know it, made sense of through our theories. So let's have that discussion. The second issue, to raise it again, because it's a central challenge of this meeting, is given that there is a past hypothesis in electrodynamics, echoing George, yes, in gravitational radiation, in statistical mechanics, is such a past hypothesis a contingent feature of our universe to be somehow explained by some accident or a contingent feature of the past? Or is it a aspect of the fundamental laws of nature and a sign that there really is a fundamental time asymmetry in nature? This is one of the key questions we're here to discuss. Before I see two hands of two friends, so I'm put in a difficult situation. Is there anybody who hasn't spoken so far who would like to make a last brief comment? Roberto.
Yes. So I'm Roberto Unger, and I speak as a complete outsider because I'm neither a physicist nor a cosmologist, nor indeed any kind of scientist. But I do want to speak in the spirit of Neil's invitation to exploit contradictions in our present ideas. So there are two ways of approaching the problems of time that have been invoked here in this conversation. First, there are general philosophical doctrines, like those of Aristotle and Bergson, that are parasitic on our experience of time. Now, we might regard it as a calamity for our experience of time to be completely undermined and denied by science, because then we would have no way of translating the discoveries of science into a discourse intelligible to us. On the other hand, we think it's the business of science to criticize and revise our experience. And so we properly rebel against these philosophical doctrines. So this approach was mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, only to be dismissed. Then we have a second approach, which is to fix on some local physics, such as statistical mechanics or electrodynamics or even quantum mechanics. It may be a physics about fundamental phenomena in some sense, but it is a physics that was designed always from the outset to explain regions of experience and not the universe as a whole. It seems to me, looking at the conversation as an outsider, that the almost totality of the interventions here have followed this tack of trying to extrapolate a local physics by scaling it up into a cosmological idea. Then we run into insurmountable problems. First, and basically, because the universe is one of a kind, these local physics are designed to explain recurrent phenomena. Then, in order to fix the resulting problem, we have to stipulate some accidental initial condition, like the low entropy state, or we have to stipulate some dogma that somehow imposes time on a world that is alien to it, like the so-called past hypothesis. This seems to me to be a hopeless enterprise and less a promising road to scientific discovery than a declaration of intellectual failure and surrender. So then we would have a third possible approach, which is to look for a properly cosmological argument. Now, the best candidate that we have for a cosmological theory in the strict sense is general relativity. But it seems hard to square general relativity with the historical character of the universe. Indeed, it was formulated right before the discoveries that led to the definition of the standard cosmological model. And it seems to be susceptible to reconciliation with a historical view of the universe, only if subject to a radical reinterpretation. So that seems to me to be the problem. And I don't understand why it is that we are all persisting in this second approach, as I described it, which seems to me to be entirely unpromising as the point of departure for a cosmological view.
Francesca Vidotto from Rabaut University. I would like to make a short comment after what Roberto said, because I don't think that there exists such a thing as a cosmological model as the one you were describing, in the sense that there are no physical models that we can provide in which you describe everything. So when we do cosmology, we are not actually describing everything. We are describing some particular degrees of freedom evolved with respect to some other. So we are never describing everything. And so there is, I don't know any concrete way in which you can have a story of everything. So if you wanted to make a story, there should always be a division between observed and observer that you should make. So I don't see any practical way to make a story of everything.
I am no longer the chair. Enrique is the chair. Shall we try? And that may be what some of us think this workshop is about. Sean?
Okay, I'm Sean Carroll from Caltech. I just wanted maybe as a little bit of a corrective. I think there are disagreements in the room, which is good. Maybe some of what Roberto just said and even the subtext of Stephen's talk has this message that perhaps things that we know about time and the arrow of time and so forth pushes us in the direction of something that would be extraordinarily radical in changing how we think about the laws of physics work and time evolves and so forth. And I take the message of what David said, which I completely agree with, which is that, you know, maybe something is completely radically different than everything we know about the laws of nature and how time fits into those laws, but certainly it's not required by anything we've been told yet. Steve says that we can explain the arrow of time and radiation by saying that all electromagnetic waves are sourced by charges. It seems manifestly clear to me that we could replace that statement by, at some early time, there were no free electromagnetic waves. That is clearly a low entropy hypothesis. It is very tangibly part of a sensible past hypothesis. Everything we know about the physics that is done in experiments, the physics of electromagnetism, et cetera, as far as I know, can be completely accounted for by conventional time-reversible dynamical laws plus some kind of past hypothesis. So very plausibly, we might need more than that, but I think zero evidence has been put forward that such a thing is required.
Just a little further along those lines, and this is a kind of soft point, and I don't want to pursue it too much, but just to the degree, you know, regarding the question of whether postulating something like a past hypothesis is more an acknowledgement of defeat than a promising scientific theory. Look, I think what astonishes everybody who thinks about this is that an enormously simple set of claims about what the initial macro state of the world was, okay, is something from which, with sufficient ingenuity, you can, or at least it looks promising that you can derive all of the different varieties of our experience of the temporal in the world. There's an astonishing variety on the level of phenomenology, on the level of phenomenological description. There's an astonishing variety of such things. The fact or the promise that all of them can be explained by adding to the dynamical laws and the statistical postulate this very simple set of claims about what the initial macro state of the world is, feels like the classic sort of scientific triumph. Things that looked initially very disparate from one another are being unified in a very simple way, so on and so forth. So, one can look at, you know, glasses half empty or glasses half full, but no, it seems to me that there are ways of looking at it where it looks very much the opposite of a sort of acknowledgement of scientific defeat.
So, I mean, just in answer to the sort of need for some radical ideas, which are likely to come from quantum gravity, So in quantum gravity is an attempt to combine quantum theory and general relativity, and they each have sort of radical and conservative features. In general relativity, causal structure itself becomes dynamical, and in quantum theory, any quantity which is dynamical is subject to superposition, or in philosophical terms, no matter of the factness. So we'd expect to have something like, fundamentally, superpositions of time-like and space-like intervals of forward and backward time intervals and so on. In other words, the notion of having fundamentally a sort of foliation into space-like hypersurfaces that you can now evolve forward in time is likely to sort of vanish when you go to quantum gravity. The idea of there being some initial time is likely to evaporate. It does look like there may be a need for some radical new ideas, a radical new way of thinking about physics that doesn't use time in this kind of fundamental way to evolve a state forward. And yet, much of the discussion still in physics is with regard to this kind of picture of a state evolving in time. The picture that David outlined is this picture of a state evolving in time. And there are very, very strong reasons to believe that's not going to be possible in quantum gravity.
So we're running out of time. I'm just going to let one last comment since Carlo had his finger up, and then we'll go for lunch.
What you're raising are issues, I think, that will be discussed in the next days. In which sense time, or in some sense its meaning, can be emergent. So I think this will be much discussed in the future. Of course, I agree with you. I mean, I very much agree with you. But my comment is much simpler. Is within the discussion of today. Today was about the direction of time. So I insist, let's separate the different problems. And in the direction of time, I think the past hypothesis should be it's the only thing we really understand about the direction of time from physics. What I want to say is, since I think we will be moving away from this discussion,
we have a whole afternoon on this discussion.
Okay, so I want to sort of violate Turok's recommendation and say that taking seriously the past hypothesis doesn't mean to give up trying to understand it. And on the table, there are proposals, and I'm violating his. There's more than one proposal. For instance, that's why I'm violating your. I have a proposal as interpreting it in a perspectival way. Past hypothesis is true, but it's true with respect to a given coarse graining, so a given macroscopical. So the microscopical state can be generic, and the macroscopical state can be special. This is possible, because entropy doesn't depend just on the microstate, it depends on the also coarse graining. And so there could be a particular coarse graining that gives it, which is determined by our way of coupling with the rest of the universe. I don't want to, this is not publicizing my work, yes it is, but but it
Carlo,
is to
I
say,
think,
wait, wait, but yeah. This is to say that the past hypothesis doesn't necessarily mean that we have to stop there. Right, and there's a proposal for Sean, which is also
and we have the full afternoon. I think what we have agreement on is two things. One of them is that the past hypothesis requires more discussion. Is it fundamental? Is it contingent? Does it disturb us? Do we celebrate it? Are we appalled by it? And the second thing is that immediately in our future is lunch, which is in the second floor bistro. And let's thank everybody who spoke today, and we return here at 2:00.